Hi, I'm Jessica Steinberg.
And I'm Amanda Borchel-Dunn. Welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East,
and the Jewish world.
Hi, welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. It's Tuesday, May 24th, and I'm Jessica Steinberg. I'm joined today by Arab Affairs reporter Aaron Boxerman and U.S. correspondent Jacob Magid. Hello to you both.
Hey, Jessica.
Hi, Jessica.
Hi. Thanks for being here today. So we're going to talk, as usual, about our current headlines, which includes a court ruling about Jewish prayer on the Temple Mount in the lead up to Jerusalem Day on Sunday, a landslide victory for Hamas at Birzeit University near Ramallah, and what that means. We've also got mixed results for pro-Israel groups in the Democratic primaries in the U.S. and the removal of radical groups from the U.S. list of terror organizations, including the Jewish Kach organization. Aaron, we're looking ahead to Jerusalem Day and what that could mean in the city of Jerusalem and the Old City. What are some of the things that you're hearing and writing about as we look up to that day, which certainly last year and in previous years sometimes does not bode well for the situation in this country?
Last week, Omer Bar-Lev, the public security minister, said that they would go forward with allowing the march, which, you know, many Palestinians in Jerusalem view as provocative, through the Damascus Gate area, winding its way through the Muslim quarter and ending at the Western Wall. Itamar Ben-Gvir, the extremist Jewish lawmaker, has also said that he intends to go onto the Temple Mount, the incredibly combustible site that is both holy to Jews and to Muslims.
We've had this ruling this week from a juvenile court judge regarding several youth who were on the Temple Mount.
So this court ruling is very much about whether three Jews who bowed on the Temple Mount and said Shema Yisrael, the central Jewish prayer, should have been giving an order barring them from the Old City for 15 days, has certainly caused a big uproar. And to some extent, the uproar is not entirely justified. Now, everything about the Temple Mount is incendiary. It's a flashpoint. It's, you know, some have called it the emotional epicenter of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and there's a lot of truth to that. But this specific court ruling was, I think, improperly framed in the Hebrew media to some extent. When the story first broke, it was as if this, you know, minor court judge had essentially given a ruling, an unprecedented ruling, frankly, allowing Jewish prayer on the Temple Mount. Now, that was neither exactly what the ruling said, and it's not exactly unprecedented. The judge did not actually say Jewish prayer in the Temple Mount is permitted. In fact, in his ruling, he said, I'm only discussing the case of whether these three Jews who prayed on the Temple Mount committed a criminal offense that warrants them being essentially barred from the Old City for 15 days. I don't believe that it amounts to the criminal offenses that the police presented in their argument. So I don't think that they should be barred. I don't think that what they did amounts to a criminal offense. But it has nothing to do with the question of freedom of worship at the Temple Mount. That is to say, the broader question of, you know, is the Temple Mount as the very fragile but, somewhat in place status quo states a place where Muslims pray and non-Muslims visit? Or is it a holy site, as some, you know, Jewish religious nationalists hope that that one day they will be able to pray in as well? That whole question was not being dealt with by the judge, and he said as much in his ruling. But as soon as the news hit, immediately Jordan condemned, Hamas condemned, from Gaza, the Palestinian Authority condemned. And to some extent, it's because of that framing that it was given in the Israeli media, which is that the judge said that there was a ruling permitting Jewish prayer on the Temple Mount. So we've seen these things before, and they don't have a lot to do with the actual on-the-ground changes that we do see happening at the Temple Mount, where we have, you know, despite claims to the contrary, seen an increasing degree in footage and from, you know, testimony of Jews praying, apparently without the police doing anything to stop it, as they may have in years past. So there are concerns about the status quo and what's going on with the status quo, and there are questions that could be asked. But this court ruling, to me at least, seems that it was poorly framed and taken a little out of proportion.
Okay, that's clarifying. Thanks, Aaron. Jacob, moving over to you, Not exactly on the same subject, but certainly looking at how Israel is being seen right now. You're writing about the Democratic primaries and that there were mixed results for the pro-Israel groups who were pushing certain candidates. What did you find out? What are you seeing? What do you think we're going to be seeing ahead of us right now?
Yeah, so last week, a number of states across the U.S. held primary elections, with a few of them proving to be bellwether races for the Democratic Party, with moderates in North Carolina and Pennsylvania pitted against progressives. AIPAC, which seeks to strengthen the U.S.'s relationship and its kind of something we call sister organization, Democratic Majority for Israel, a newer group that seeks to bolster support for Israel specifically within the Democratic Party amid shifting dynamics, chose to weigh in quite heavily in these races on behalf of the slate of moderate candidates and against their progressive opponents. AIPAC earlier this year launched a PAC and a super PAC, which allows for uncapped spending, and DMFI used its PAC to a political action committee to make contributions of its own to centrists, though these ones came at like a fraction of what the AIPAC PAC, super PAC, United Democracy Project was spending. Mm-hmm. So there were three races that saw particularly high amounts of spending: North Carolina's 1st District, North Carolina's 4th District, where AIPAC spent over $2 million in each race, and DMFI spent roughly $750,000. And then in the Pennsylvania's 12th District, AIPAC, Super PAC, UDP spent $2.7 million, and DMFI PAC spent another $400,000 in a race where their slated candidate, Steve Irwin, or the one that they backed, lost to progressives. The races led to peaking anger, it seemed, among progressive candidates with AIPAC and DMFI, who before these races may not have been totally known to all Democrats, but now it's definitely not the case.
All right, obviously we'll keep on following that with you. Let's take a quick break.
Hi, podcast listeners. The Times of Israel is celebrating a decade this year, and I'm happy to invite you to our kickoff TOI at 10 live event series. Join us May 24th at Jerusalem's First Station for Who by Fire, Leonard Cohen and the Yom Kippur War. Author Matti Friedman will be in conversation with TOI editor David Horvitz to discuss his new book on the singer-priest's extraordinary tour for IDF troops in 1973. And of course, there will be live music. If you're in Israel, please join us. If you're not, we'll share a recording after the event exclusively with our TOI community members. For more information and tickets, go to timesofisrael.com/TOI10. That's timesofisrael.com/TOI10. Hope to see you there.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him on, like, after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their, like, blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
We're going to go back to Aaron now, speaking about the victory of Hamas, essentially political party, in a sense, at Beer Zeit University over Fatah, which is the essentially the ruling party. What does that say, Aaron, about what's happening in Palestinian society, obviously, on this college campus? What does it really mean in terms of how we understand things?
So Palestinians have not seen national elections in about 15 years since Hamas, the terror group that rules Gaza, beat Fatah in parliamentary elections in 2006. But, you know, even over the last couple of years, you know, we've seen attempts by the Palestinians to hold talks and even to hold an election last year, and it didn't really happen. So people look at these student elections, which, you know, we might think, okay, a college student election, what does this really matter? Right. But people really look at them as a bellwether for public opinion. Now, college students are not necessarily representative, but Bir Zeit University is sort of the West Bank's flagship university. It's located just north of Ramallah. And people do set, you know, quite highly by what happens at Bir Zeit. In the past, these student councils generally, and specifically Bir Zeit, were seen very much as Fatah strongholds. But it's gotten much closer in recent years, especially as the Palestinian Authority, which is dominated by the Fatah party, has, you know, declined in popularity. The PA is widely seen as corrupt and ineffectual and not particularly able to positively influence the lives of Palestinians in the West Bank. And during the last election, it was something like 23-23 Fatah Hamas with a few unaffiliated seats. This time, Hamas took 28 out of 51 seats, Fatah took 18, and the rest went to a leftist party. Again, like I said, people really see these events, which we might view as just, you know, a college election, you know, how important could it be right. in the absence of national elections, as a potential weather vane in terms of where things are going in the West Bank. I watched the debate, which was streamed pretty widely on Palestinian social media. And wow. you could see that there was a lot of energy with, you know, from the crowd, you know, for the Hamas debater, as, you know, he was attacking the Fatah debater for all sorts of alleged scandals that have happened over the past couple of years. You know, accusations that the PA's political strategy vis-a-vis Israel is going nowhere, while Hamas's strategy of using violence, terrorism, rocket attacks has achieved results and brought dignity to Palestinians. And, you know, we could see that in the results that at the very least among, you know, these younger students at Bir Zeit University, more people seem to be buying into it, whether as out of support for the terror group or as a matter of a protest vote against the West Bank's ruling party.
Okay, that's pretty fascinating. Jacob, talk to us about the removal of several radical groups from the U.S. list of terror organizations, including the Jewish organization Kach.
The State Department on Friday announced that it was removing five extremist groups from its Foreign Terrorist Organizations list, FTO. Among them is one that is familiar to Israelis, Kahane Chai, or Kach. The Kach movement was born out of a political party led by far-right Rabbi Meir Kahane, who was elected to the Knesset in 1984 and then later barred from running again by the Supreme Court due to his incitement from violence. But Kach continued its activities after Kahane's assassination in 1990 and was later outlawed as a terror organization by Israeli authorities first in, following the 1994 massacre at the Tomb of the Patriarchs carried out by Baruch Goldstein, who was a supporter of Kahane's. And then in 1997, it was placed on the FTO list of the State Department. Members of Kach have killed and attacked or otherwise threatened Arabs, Palestinians, and Israeli government officials, but the organization has been dormant since 2005. So why did we see this State Department decision now? I spoke with a senior U.S. official who explained that according to U.S. law, FTO designations must be reviewed every 5 years. And if there isn't proof that a group remains active in its terror support, it must be removed from the list. The review was launched during the Trump administration, but was never finished. And then after determining that Kach warranted a revocation, Biden officials tried to delay the move, knowing the political costs. Ultimately, though, the State Department lawyers told the administration that they were failing to comply with the law and had to delist the five organizations. What this move might do, though, is provide tailwind to Kahane's disciples in Israel, such as Ben-Gvir and others in the Otzma Yehudit neo-Kahane's party who have been barred from, others of his colleagues who have been barred from running due to incitement for violence. Now, they aren't official Kach members. Again, it's kind of like a dormant organization, and their listed violations are more recent than the ones when we're talking about Kach, but they still can point to this move some of these more extremists and say, look, even the U.S. Doesn't view Kach as a terror organization, and yet Israel does. How does that make any sense? And I think there's also anger at the Palestinian Authority, where civilian affairs minister Hussein Sheikh blasted the move and asked why Kach was being delisted, while a separate 1987 law deeming the PLO and its affiliates to be terrorist organizations remains on the books. The PA will argue that they have relations with it, they have agreements signed with Israel, they have official relations with Israel and with the U.S., and yet they're still deemed a terror organization. It's not very political beneficial to for any U.S. administration right now to remove that designation, particularly when the PA continues to pay stipends to security prisoners. Until that changes, I don't see the 1987 law remaining or being scrapped at all.
Got it. And here, Jacob, you have a piece about U.S. ambassador's new residence in Jerusalem. It's in the German colony, I understand.
At the end of last week, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, Tom Nides, moved into a new residence. He's been staying at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel for the past 6 months, about, since he arrived in November. And now the U.S. embassy found a new residence for him in downtown Jerusalem on Emek Rephaim Street and Yoshia Wedgwood.
Wedgwood. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's a pretty great location in the yuppity German colony. And basically the reason why it kind of was a question where he was going to live and why he didn't really have a house was because the U.S. ambassador's residence used to be a seaside compound in Herzliya, a suburb of Tel Aviv, where the embassy used to be located. But then the U.S. moved the embassy to Jerusalem, and the Trump administration, in order to prevent future administrations from moving the embassy back and putting the ambassador back in the Herzliya, they sold the compound, which is quite gorgeous, to Sheldon Adelson, who is no longer with us. And that meant that the ambassadors have been staying either in the old consulate building in on Agron Street, or in Nides' case, in the hotel. And so now he has this official residence, or it's almost official. The embassy filed a request with the foreign ministry to mark it as an official residence, and that's where we expect him to be, or the ambassador to be, situated for the next few years. Eventually, because the U.S. embassy is making a new building elsewhere in Jerusalem, there'll also be a ambassador's residence in that new place. But it's going to take probably 5-10 years.
All right. A little real estate to end today's podcast. Thank you, Jacob. And thank you, Aaron, for being with us on today, Tuesday's Daily Briefing.
Thanks, Jessica.
Thanks, Jessica.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing, and thanks to our producer, Gilad Brownstein, and to Gili Amar for this out-of-this-world music.
You can find us daily wherever you find your podcasts.
And on our mothership, timesofisrael.com. Like what you hear? Consider rating us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to spread the word.
And be sure to check out our weekly feature, Times Will Tell, released every Friday. Until next time,
Shalom.